I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 838. We had anticipated that we would do a public hearing today and then move into work session. Looking at the list of folks that we have still ready to testify, I seriously doubt we're going to make it to even opening a work session today. And I want to make sure that today we get in everybody who has signed up to testify. This will be the last day for public testimony, barring some reason for somebody to give me why we should reopen it again. So the intention would be that we close up our public testimony today on 838, and that next Tuesday we open up the work session and try and get through all of the amendments if we can. And if we're able to dispose of the bill one way or the other on Tuesday, we will do it. I'm going to want to give the committee all the time that it needs to have a full discussion in work session of the amendments and the eventual bill. So if we can do all that in one day next Tuesday, we will. If it requires some overflow, then we'll overflow into next Thursday as well. But that's what we are planning on. Also, I do seriously want to make sure that everybody gets a chance today. And there are probably, 20 people that are signed up. So I'm going to caution once again, if you can do it, keep your testimony to about 3 minutes so that everybody gets a chance. And I'm going to start with the folks that were here last time and did not have a chance to testify. And then I'm going to go to people who are more than 100 miles away, if there are any. And then I think we'll get through it. Actually, what I will do is I'll go through the people that were here last time, and then we will go to Commissioner Schrader, and then we will go on from there. So first, Dan Campbell, Diane Broad, and Jeff Hammerland.
Oh, he'll be here at 3:30.
Oh, Jeff isn't here. Angus Duncan, then, will be the third in that panel. Dan Campbell, Diane Broad, Angus Duncan.
Coming, next.
Martha Pellegrino. Martha Schrader. Tony Hyde.
That's good.
Make sure I don't. All right, next I'll just put it right here. But I'm going to get him as soon as he gets in.
Okay.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino with the City of Portland. I'm here today testifying in support of Senate Bill 838, the Oregon Renewable Energy Act. I've just submitted a letter of support from Commissioner Dan Saltzman, so I will not read this testimony, but I'll just highlight a few points for the committee. First, Senate Bill 838 is certainly consistent with the city's sustainable development goals and practices. In 2001, jointly with Multnomah County, we developed a 10-year strategy for reducing CO2 emissions to a level 10% below our 1990 footprint. The underlying intent of that global warming, the local action plan on global warming, was to gain a competitive advantage, preserving livability and cutting pollution through energy efficiency and by increasing our use of renewable energy. The plan sets out an ambitious goal for our city that by 2010, 100% of the energy we buy for municipal use will come from renewable resources. This legislation is very important for many, many reasons that have been mentioned, so we will not go over each of them, but I certainly wanted to acknowledge the very hard work of the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group and of this committee for taking up this very ambitious legislation that is important to the livability of all of our communities. So with that, I will thank the committee.
Nicely done, Ms. Pellegrino. Any questions? None? Thank you. Commissioner?
Here we go.
Very glad to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you, Chair Avakian. It's a pleasure to be here with such wonderful colleagues, Senator Beyer, Senator Prozanski, and yourself, Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Martha Schrader. I am the chairwoman of the Clackamas County Commission, and I also have the privilege of being the chair of the Association of Oregon County's Community Development Steering Committee. And I am here today to present you with a letter of endorsement from Bobby Green. who is president of the Association of Oregon Counties, in support, with AOC support, for the Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard. It's our hope that these policy recommendations will build a robust renewable energy industry in our great state of Oregon. It is important that Oregon's government and both rural and urban Oregon get behind a policy that says renewable energy is in our future. It is very critical for our state, and Senate Bill 838, along with its companion legislation, House Bill 2210, 2211, and 2212, which will be a package with state and local tax incentives, will show that we are really willing to invest in a new and innovative economy. These tools, which will be carefully developed, will fit into our Oregon tradition of sustainability and a progressive, practical way of doing business. Public and private stakeholders have been intimately involved in these issues, and they have spent many hours over the last year developing the recommendations that are the basis of this Senate bill. And with this background, we hope that it is time to move forward. We do know that there's going to be potentially additional amendments, negotiations, but that's a good thing. That is the way we do business here in Oregon. We believe that legislative action on this measure will show a partnership with the local communities that want and need renewable energy industries, and with diminishing resources at many of our local levels, particularly in many Oregon counties, this could be an economic development shot in the arm, which will help increase local tax bases critical to our counties, as well as increased investments in jobs. This will help Oregon. It will help rural Oregon. It will help urban Oregon. Small community projects and large-scale developments producing renewable energy will allow Oregon to buy locally instead of just buying, providing a resource that is shipped elsewhere to meet the state's renewable energy needs. In particular, I have to mention that my own county hopes to be one of the leaders in wave energy technology. We have one of a huge traded sector business, Oregon Ironworks, in our county that is doing the prototypes at this time for developing the technology for renewable wave energy. We are very proud of that business. We are very proud of the added capacity they are bringing to the renewable energy conversation. I would like to just finish by saying the passage of this bill is going to be good for our state, it's going to be good for business, and it does have the full support of the Association of Oregon Counties. And with that, I'd like to introduce my good colleague and vice chair of the Community Development Steering Committee, Tony Hyde.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tony Hyde, Commissioner in Columbia County, also Commissioner on the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. To that end, I do want to testify on behalf of this bill and the importance. And I want to share with you a little story, if I may, in less than 3 minutes. We just got off the phone with Senator Wyden's staff, and it sounds like that there's going to be an announcement almost immediately about a bill that's going to hit the floor either Monday or Tuesday that we hope is a deal that's being cut with some certainty that will give us what we're now calling a slow starvation, but at least it's something with regard to the forced payments. It gives us full funding for 1 year and then ramps down 10% a year until the final year we end up with 40%. The importance of that is the conversation that we had with Senator Wyden in his office a week and a half ago, where he started looking beyond the 5 years of extension for counties and truly the state of Oregon. And what he's talking about is there's no way that we're ever going to get back up to the harvest level that we enjoyed with federal forests and state of Oregon. That's just a fact. So we have to figure out a different way of getting revenue out of the federal forests. And the very first thing out of the senator's mouth was we need to start talking about biofuels and getting the biofuel harvest out of the forest. And he said, Oregon needs to get in the game. We need to create a market for that. And we, again, we're looking in terms of the federal forest revenues that we've enjoyed for 80 years. We're now looking at a 5-year slowdown. And we have to figure out a new way of doing business out of the federal forest. This is clearly an opportunity for us to do that. Having said that, I also want to point out that I have two PUDs and one co-op in my district. And I understand that they have issues with this. I would implore you to find a way to make a deal where everybody at the table and the stakeholders involved can find this palatable to create a market in the state of Oregon. But we need to be in the game, and we need to be in the game sooner rather than later.
Very good. Committee?
No, thank you.
Nothing? Commissioner? Others, thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. Now, your husband, you know, is, for those that are here and don't know, Kurt Schrader, chair of the Senate chair of the Ways and Means Committee, is the spouse of Commissioner Schrader. You probably don't see him much anymore. We don't see much anymore either. He's hunkered down in the budget. Do you need us to call him to committee or something?
So yeah, well, I tell you, we do have Friday date nights, though.
Oh, Friday date nights.
make an effort.
Well, so. If you have a shopping list we need to give to him, just give it to us. We'll make sure he brings it home.
Yeah. You guys are just so bad.
Yes, I know. Thank you. The next three, Gary Langenwalter, Rashad Henry, and I'm very sorry, but Calvin from Bend, I can't make out the last name. Oh, sure. Come on up.
Good afternoon, Chair Avakian, or is it Avakian?
Avakian. Avakian. Thanks for asking.
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Beyer. My name is Gary Langenwalter. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 838. And I've got several hats. I am a native Oregonian, born in Hermiston. I now live in Tigard, so I've been on both sides of the continental divide. I'm speaking as chair of the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign, as a business consultant, as a father, and as a United Methodist pastor. And those are not mutually exclusive. They all come together in what I'm going to say. Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign is a program of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We've held two gatherings on climate stewardship here in Salem in the last year. Last June, we drew 60 people. We were hoping for 30, got 60. February 26th, we were hoping for 60 and got 150. So there is great interest throughout the state. And I'm entering an article about the gathering on February 26th into the record. Now, we're from all religions, evangelical, mainline Protestant, Roman Catholic, Jew, Muslim, New Thought, and Native American. They were all represented at the last gathering. Our position on energy generation and consumption rests on four key principles. First, justice, especially for the poor and the vulnerable. Second, stewardship, limiting the impacts of global warming. Third, sustainability, care of the Earth's systems so they can sustain life long term. And fourth, sufficiency, ensuring that all have enough. And I'm entering the testimony of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon into the record today. Now, at the hearing on this bill last Thursday, I was privileged to watch our democracy in action, and I noticed two things. One, committee members and the administrator listened intently. Thank you. As a citizen, I am impressed. Listening is hard work. But second, almost all the testimony focused on money, on the economic impact of this bill, on ratepayers, whether they're individuals or consumers. And as important as economics are, they should not be, must not be, the final determining factor on the passage of this bill or any other bill, because energy is a moral issue. I've spent 30 years in the business world and have been in hundreds of companies around the world, from New Zealand to Crete. The one common denominator across all those companies is pictures of people's families, their spouse, their children, their grandchildren. And parents around the world willingly sacrifice so their children can have better lives. The people who talk about the economics of this bill or other bills seem to assume that we can continue with business as usual, taking resources from the ground, processing them, and putting the waste into the environment, and that this won't affect the earth or its ability to support our lives. Those assumptions are wrong. The earth's resources are not infinite, nor is the earth's ability to absorb the toxins that we create. I'm going to Australia in May to lead classes on sustainability. My first visit will be to Ballarat, a city which used to have a large, beautiful lake right in the middle of it as its key identifying feature, their version of Mount Hood. They now walk across a dry lake bed. And my consulting will be on how businesses can adjust to a 5-year drought and shortages of raw materials. So the process of considering this legislation is democracy in action, and I'm proud of that. But democracy's major weakness is that the only people who can testify face-to-face here with you today are those who are currently alive. Future generations have no ability to speak to you. Ask yourself, who is considering the well-being of our citizens 50 years out, 100 years out, 500 years out? Ask yourself, if we continue to degrade the earth, how will our grandchildren live? So I beg of you, when you're considering legislation, this or other bills, look carefully at the picture of your children. You don't get to keep this. Look at the picture of your children and your grandchildren and vote on their behalf. That's who your decisions will ultimately affect. And vote to respect and preserve our earth, because in the final analysis, that's the most important legacy we can leave our children. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Henry.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, my name is Rashad Henry. I'm here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. I've submitted written testimony. I'm not going to read that today, but each organization supports Senate Bill 838, and we urge that you pass it through. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Calvin Mukamoto. I'm the manager for Warm Springs Biomass LLC, and that's a tribal entity that's developing the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation Biomass Project. Thank you, Chair Avakian, for allowing me this opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 838. Chairman Ron Suppa of the tribe sends his apology, but has submitted testimony in support of the legislation. I'll make it quick. I'm not going to read from my testimony. I have submitted a written testimony, but basically what we're trying to do at Warm Springs is expand the biomass power at the Warm Springs Forest Products Mill to 15.5 megawatts to the grid. And what this has a benefit to is creates a marketplace solution for the overstock forest and helps or could help assist the agencies in the tribe reduce their susceptibility to major forest fires. We see other benefits from this this expansion, and that's the creation and sustainability of some jobs in the area, including in the logging community, but and also in the plant itself, which may equate to 60 or more jobs in the small community of Warm Springs, which is significant. And also, there's significant environmental benefits to this. There was a study done by Greg Morris for National Renewable Energy Labs in 1999 on woody biomass energy production, such as ours, and he came up with a public benefit from environmental services alone of 11.4 cents per kilowatt. Now, the most that public utilities are willing to pay for right now are in the 6-cent range. You can see the difference just on a public benefit standpoint. This makes sense. This renewable energy portfolio standard makes sense for Oregon as a public benefit. Now, specifically, I have two comments in this bill that specifically are more technical. One relates to the not allowing municipal solid waste material into these plants. We will continue to want to burn pure wood waste that's averted from landfills, and that might be considered to be MSW in this bill, and we don't want that to happen. The reason why it creates a lot of benefits. One, because of the limitations on the power side, we can only afford to pay so much for fuel. The cheaper fuel from landfills that are clean, and I've attached the our tech specs to the testimony so you can review them, but allows us to pay and afford the higher priced forest fuel, so we can continue to be a tool for forest management. The second, there's two other benefits there to the public. One, it causes the landfills to fill up slower, reduces the rate, which is a benefit to society. And two, when you throw wood into biodegrade into the landfill, it creates actually more harmful greenhouse gases. And there will be a study on life cycle analysis coming out about that this year, and I can probably obtain that at some point and bring it to you. The second technical problem we have with the bill is the public benefit side, we are currently negotiating with the Energy Trust of Oregon. Unfortunately, because we need to pin and ink a deal with the power company real soon, we won't benefit from this great bill, the power prices, but we do need the help of the Energy Trust. And there's a part of the bill that says that if you have if you're over a maximum of 20 megawatts nominal, you do not qualify for the public benefit side. We just want to make sure that there's language in there that allows us to continue to operate. We understand there are some amendments being proposed, and we're in support of those. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mukimoto, and we did get your information about that and are considering it, and will next Tuesday as well. Committee, anything? No. Thank you, the three of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Jason Williams, Michael Early, John Charles.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Taxpayer Association Director, and it's good to be here this afternoon. We're very worried about this bill because it does renew the 3% utility tax, which we see is a tax on an essential cost of living expenditure for people. And it's pretty clearly when you're taxing people's electricity, you're taxing their ability to heat their home, have their refrigerator, and to light their home. And so you're taking something that is an essential activity for people to pay for something that is an unessential goal. The goal is not unimportant, but it is unessential because government already has a lot of regulations, environmental regulations, hundreds of millions of dollars already to help protect the environment. So when we look at the impact upon people and on how last year we saw a record amount of people requesting help with their heating bills, is it really fair to balance it on their backs for this goal? And because of the mandates in some of these proposals that we are looking at, it not only will that continue the 3% tax, but it will make the rates even higher because a lot of these renewable energies cost more. So we are seeing we're hitting people where it really matters the most for something that could be easily taken care of in another part of government. And we feel that sometimes when you force some of these renewable energies, which it's our understanding that hydropower is not listed as a renewable energy, and we do not understand that. We think it should be, but that the market forces work best. There's been a lot of environmental renewable energy alternative ideas that have failed, a lot of them that have taken a lot of government money, a lot of mandates that went nowhere, and that is a waste of energy. And we feel like when the market forces, that applies competition and pressure, and some of the best ideas in energy alternatives came because it was what the people liked and it was what the people were going to do. So we would oppose some of these proposals around this bill and just ask that we would try to maybe rely on some of the volunteerism that we've already become famous for here in Oregon in terms of people in choosing their green power, which we're becoming nationally recognized. Let's build upon that volunteerism, choice, and competition, and not introduce more mandates. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Early.
Thank you, Chairman Avakian and members of the committee. My name is Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. I'd like to discuss three of our major concerns with the Dash 2 amendments, and by way of being constructive, identify how the Dash 8 amendments address those concerns in a way that we think is positive. First, we have some concerns with how renewables is defined in the Dash 2 amendments. Frankly, it's just it's unprincipled, and it's a bit of a mishmash. If you just look at hydro generally is not included, but upgrades are included. 50 average megawatts per utility of low impact hydro is included. If there's an upgrade of Bonneville, the Oregon share is included, but not the remainder. There just isn't any particular principled driving that those those lines that have been arbitrarily drawn in the statute. We think, frankly, that hydro is renewable. There's no reason to distinguish it from wind, and it ought to be included. Similarly, there's a 1995 cutoff. There's no principled basis for excluding early actors, so we think there ought not to be a cutoff. So in the Dash 8 amendments, we include all of hydro. We include, there's no vintaging cutoff for resources. And in terms of establishing the targets, what we think you should do is establish a baseline target. Look at each utility at a date certain. We suggest 2007. This is the establish the baseline renewables used to serve Oregon load for that date, and then build the percentages based upon that target. So we claim credit for what we have done to date, and we should do that, and we're entitled to do that, and it helps us in promoting Oregon as green and attracting businesses who want to invest in renewable industries. Take credit for what we have and build upon that, and use percentages that relate in some way to what do we expect for load growth to occur, what we expect to see in terms of aggressive conservation, and recognizing that as we add wind, we're also going to have to add additional energy out of thermal resources to firm that up. So the percentages that we build upon the base have to be tied in some fashion to what we expect to happen in the future as load grows and we meet it with renewables, conservation, and other firming thermal resources. Secondly, our second issue is cost protection. I'm here today to tell you that from a large customer's point of view, the cost cap in the Dash 2 amendments do not provide me any comfort that my rates will actually be constrained by that provision. The cost cap is not a rate cap. It is a comparison between costs actually incurred for renewables versus a hypothetical resource that is never acquired. It's a determination that's going to be made at one time, but it's going to be in effect for 20-odd years. So it doesn't account for changes in what might have happened to that resource. Secondly, it's a levelized comparison. It may well, and I expect it will, bring costs forward. So on a levelized basis, it may be 4%, but my rate impact in years 1, 2, and 3 may be significantly higher than 4%. And frankly, many of my members are not in a position to continue to be competitive with significant rate hikes. What we're looking for in the bill, that in the Dash 8 amendments, the cost caps don't focus on the revenue requirement. They focus on a rate impact test so that there's a limit on how much rates can increase in each rate period for each rate class. Secondly, there's a limit that compares the cost of the renewable resources versus the cost of the thermal resource that might otherwise have been acquired. It parallels what's in the federal statute relating to Bonneville, that you shouldn't be allowed to acquire a renewable if it costs more than 110% of the alternative, some reasonable cap that keeps the rate pressure on customers reasonable. And lastly, we're including, the Dash 8 amendments include a provision that allows the commission, the Oregon Public Service Commission, to take the utility off the targeted rates if compliance would cause a material adverse impact on rates. Frankly, we don't know, the utilities don't know, how the renewable industry is going to develop over the next 20 years, and we need to have some sort of safety valve in the hands of the commission that allows us to moderate those rate impacts. Lastly, there were late additions into the Dash 2 amendments which dealt with cost recovery issues. There's the inclusion of an automatic adjustment clause for the utilities. Frankly, we don't know why this was included. It introduces another divisive issue into a bill that already has enough disagreements about it. It doesn't really affect whether the targets are met or what the targets are. Frankly, it is unnecessary. It shifts the relative risks between shareholders and customers in terms of cost recovery. The cost recovery mechanisms we have today work fine. Our recommendation is to simply leave them alone and not change that. Finally, just so you understand what an automatic adjustment clause does from a customer's point of view, it's asymmetrical, frankly, that if a utility has overall costs increasing, it's going to file a general rate case because it's going to want to recover all of its costs. But if it's in a situation where its costs are going down, it's aggressively reducing its costs, and yet at the same time it's bringing on renewable resources, what this does is it allows it to bring a single issue rate case. I want to recover the costs of my new resource, but I don't want to have to deal with the fact that my other costs are going down. So I'm going to raise rates to recover the costs for my new resource, but I don't want to have to account for the additional savings I'm making because my other costs are going down. So the automatic adjustment clause gives the utility two options. I can either, if my costs are going up, I'm going to file a general no matter what, because I want to recover all my costs. If my costs are going down but I'm adding a resource, this gives me a tool that gives me an advantage, and we think that's unfair. Thank you very much.
Charles?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute, a market-oriented research center. I'd like to make three primary points today. First, we don't think the bill is necessary given Oregon's low-carbon energy supply system. Second, it interferes with existing green power programs. And third, it exposes high costs to ratepayers with no offsetting benefits. I should say, by way of background, I was not part of the Renewable Energy Working Group, and so I'm not party to any kind of informal agreements on this bill, and I just offer this as someone who's been involved in natural resource policy for the last 30 years in Oregon. My first point is Oregon already has one of the least carbon-intensive supply systems in the nation. I have here a data set showing we're 48th out of the 50, including District of Columbia, 48 out of 51, far below the dirtiest states like West Virginia or the district. So it might be nice to be number 51, but we don't exactly have a crisis. And I note in passing that the states that are the least carbon-intense all use as primary sources of energy those that are disqualified under this bill. Second, the bill is redundant because Oregon ratepayers already have the option of purchasing green power, and relative to our peer states, many of our programs actually have been pretty successful. You can see PGE, PacifiCorp, Emerald PUD, participation rates are going up, which means this is redundant because people are choosing to vote with their dollars to do this more over time. In the case of EWEB, the reverse is true. For four consecutive years, EWEB customers have had a declining participation rate, indicating they're not interested in paying more. So again, the bill is redundant because why would you impose this on them if roughly 98% of them aren't interested in doing it? I'm surprised. If someone passed a ballot measure by even 52 to 48, you would be unlikely to overturn that here. And yet we have 96% of Oregonians, roughly ratepayers, opting not to do this. So I don't know what the moral or intellectual basis is for forcing this on them when they keep voting month after month after month with their pocketbooks not to do this. To show in Table 3, customer participation rates nationwide for green pricing programs are not even close to Oregon's. They're barely 1% and not going much faster, up much faster. And more importantly, the price differential for between green power and mainstream power, it would be nice if that was declining over time, and in some cases, I'm sure it is, but nationwide, between 1999 and 2005, it was flat. There is a surcharge of about 2 cents per kilowatt hour, which, given retail rates in Oregon, would work out to about a 37% surcharge. That's one of the reasons consumers aren't interested. I think the problem with mandates, especially mandates going far out, is they sort of create this hoopla and this notion that we're going to do it, and then what happens when we don't? Chicago received a lot of publicity in 2001 for going renewable, and by 2006 it had all flamed out. They didn't accomplish it. And so I would encourage you not to go way out to 2025. I think if you're going to do this, I would start kicking in some standards as soon as 2010, and I indicate some language here on page 4 of my testimony, capping at 215. And I'll give some credit to the City of Portland here in that regard. In 2001, as a previous witness mentioned, they voted to go 100% renewable by 2010. Well, as of my phone call to the city last week, they're about 98% shy of their goal. Only they're only getting 2%, and they have 3 years to make it up. So they're probably not going to do it, but at least many of the people who promoted that in 2001 are likely to still be around in 2010, and they can be accountable for those actions. Putting a goal to 2025 means the burden is put off to the future. My final point is the public purpose tax. I think it was due to sunset in 2012. I think you should let it die. It served its purpose. I think the money that you're taking from ratepayers can be much better spent in their pockets. So my conclusion is that essentially what this does is it begins to create a carbon cartel. The purpose of any cartel, or at least the effect, is to drive up the price of the cartelized commodity. That's good for some people, but generally speaking, it's bad for the people forced to pay more, and that's ratepayers. Thank you.
Committee? Nothing. Thank you, three of you.
Thank you.
Tom O'Connor, Jason Huser, and Mike Graney. Mr. Graney, you're only going to be in the seat for a minute. I called you up just because there has been, actually over the several days that we've heard testimony occasionally, this notion of a cost cap versus a rate cap comes up. I would guess that most people watching or listening don't even know the lingo that we're using or talking about. And I wonder if you could just briefly comment on the difference between the two and why the cost cap is included in the dash twos instead of a rate cap.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. First, the idea of a cost cap or rate cap, it gets very complicated very quickly in terms of utility rates and revenue requirements. The formula we have is actually based on revenues for the utilities, and that was with the advice of the Public Utility Commission as the most accurate way of determining the impacts of, if there are any, resulting from the renewable standard being complied with versus utilities simply acquiring resources as they would otherwise, whether through an integrated resource plan or otherwise. So that the formulation and the wording there is based on PUC advice as the best way to be able to actually determine this from an economic point of view.
Okay, thank you. Committee, any questions about that before we move on?
Just one quick question, because of the previous testimony, I got the dash twos out and read through that section once again. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me, and I'm not an expert, this so help me out, if the annual revenues didn't support in a given year continuation of compliance, if that utility wanted to get a rate change, they'd have to go through the PUC. Is that not true? They have to have a rate hearing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I'm not a PUC rate expert either, but if I understand your question, for a rate increase, they would have to get approval. That'd be correct.
So in essence, even though... In essence, even though this says annual revenue requirements for the clients here, ultimately you're still talking about a rate cap. The net effect is the same.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, that's correct. It is a rate cap. It's a question of how you formulate it. And in terms of, I guess, the PUC rate proceedings, I think when they make a rate case determination, there's some leeway in what that range of increase is. Again, what this is a comparison, keep in mind, of what the impacts of the renewable energy standard would be on rates versus rates which are likely to rise increase anyway simply from the costs of, say, fossil fuels as the base case or the default case in comparison, and that's where the revenue issue comes in as the basis for the formulation.
So my understanding is that the fears we've heard about skyrocketing electrical costs as a result of renewables, this is the governor for it. This is the one that slows that down and prevents it from occurring.
Bates, that is correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Graney.
Thank you.
We're coming up. Mr. O'Connor? Two of you were here a week or two ago, and we didn't get to you. I'm sorry about that, but I'm glad that you were able to be back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, representing Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. If I may, before I start, just, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, the cost cap is extremely important, and yes, the cost cap is designed as a limitation. However, I think it is really important that everyone understands that a 4% cost cap doesn't necessarily translate into a 4% rate cap in every case. My utilities have different rate structures, and so the rate impact could be different, but it is a limitation. That being said, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, last year, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association adopted a resolution describing our principles for consideration of an Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard. The resolution said that we support the use of goals rather than mandates, but if there was going to be a state policy mandate, it should be based on the principles that we outlined in that document. We've worked over the last year and a half with the governor's office, our local legislators, and the proponents of the Oregon RPS. We took these principles into our discussions and negotiations. We didn't get everything we wanted, but on balance, we believe the -2 amendments meet the test of our principles. We support the -2 amendments with the additions suggested on the attachment of my testimony. Here's how we came to that conclusion. Our first principle was that the RPS should not cause a reduction in our share of federal preference power from BPA. That's virtually 100% greenhouse gas free power. In the bill, Section 8, Sub 3 states that a utility may reduce its RPS obligation in order to avoid such a reduction in our lowest cost BPA power. There's similar language in the bill for our low-cost hydro contracts with the Mid-Columbia PUD projects. That's in Section 8, Sub 2. Our second principle, targets should focus on load growth. Well, this bill does focus on total load, not load growth. But the fact that we exempt BPA Tier 1 and the Mid-C contracts for us accomplishes much the same thing as focusing on load growth. Not entirely, but much the same thing. There's also language that states that a utility may reduce its target obligation to the extent that the RPS would require it to displace or reduce its non-fossil fuel electricity that it already has. Principle number three. Local elected officials must retain flexibility to determine the most effective mix of renewables and conservation needed to meet targets. In the bill, there are no hard carve-outs or special mandates for subcategories of resources, which we opposed. The utility may use alternative compliance payments to fund local conservation projects. And there's a robust list of eligible renewable resources, including cogen, new hydro, upgrades to existing hydro, including upgrades to the BPA and the Mid-C facilities. Our fourth principle was that the RPS should avoid new regulation or what we call micromanagement by either our friends in the Department of Energy or the PUC. In regard to that, the bill does not do that. It does not contain that new regulation. It sets up a system of alternative compliance payments instead of penalties. Our local governing boards review compliance and provide yearly reports to customers. Our local governing boards set the level of ACP payments based on a similar methodology to that used by the PUC. Our local governing boards also determine our revenue requirement used in the 4% cost cap. Finally, our last principle, number five, targets should be reasonable, flexible, and meaningful, and should include off-ramps to avoid economic harm to our customers. The targets in the out years, in particular, are very aggressive. There's no question about that. 25% by 2025 is very aggressive. Our ability to meet those out-year targets will depend greatly on the region's cooperative effort to secure adequate transmission, the availability of the Columbia River hydro system, and additional fossil fuel resources to shape and firm variable resources like wind. And finally, for most important for small utilities that I work with, the availability of a Tier 2 renewable resource product from BPA. That being said, the bill does try to address those kinds of uncertainties. There is a more modest target for small utilities. We talked about the 4% cost cap. There's a wide geographic area to draw upon to obtain eligible resources. There are flexibility mechanisms, including the use of what are called unbundled renewable energy certificates, which can be traded and banked. And there's no limit on the use of those renewable energy certificates for smaller utilities. And if a utility is otherwise unable to comply with the standard, they can use an alternative compliance payment to fund conservation or bank for future. I guess in conclusion, we believe the Dash 2 draft on balance meets the test of the principles we adopted. So we didn't get everything we wanted, but on balance, we feel it does meet that test. It's important to recognize, however, that implementing this RPS will not be an easy task. Many of our customers tell us they want us to look first to renewable resources, but our customers also tell us they're concerned about cost and they want to make sure we keep our service reliable and safe. OMEU members will start new 20-year power sales contracts with BPA in 2011. Under these new contracts, we will be responsible for meeting our own load growth in the future, either through BPA or other sources. We recognize the incredible value our largest renewable resource, the Columbia River Hydro System, has brought to our communities. The question now is, how do we build on that asset as we make our choices for the future? The policies in this bill call upon us to meet load growth largely with renewables and the resources necessary for shaping and firming them. 2025 is a long time from now. I anticipate we will be back to talk with you about adjustments to this legislation as we go along toward the goal over time. But it's important to get started. If we don't get started, the cost of future efforts required to deal with the effects of carbon and climate change will be even greater. We believe this legislation does put us on the path most Oregonians want, and we support this approach.
Thank you.
Chair Vakian, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Huser, a Legislative Affairs Representative for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. EWEB is the state's largest consumer-owned utility at 83,000 customers. I'm here to tell you that today we're here in support of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 838. At the inception of an Oregon RPS proposal, EWEB recognized the effectiveness a well-crafted statewide approach could achieve. Our only trepidation came from the possible unintended consequences for utilities that had made commitments to renewables long before that was common or required. In EWEB's case, we've been pursuing an ambitious conservation and renewables acquisition strategy dating back to the late 1980s. And our portfolio today is about as renewable as any comparable utility in the country our size. There was a gentleman on one of the previous panels that suggested that there's been less of a demand for renewables at EWEB. I would take some exception to that. I'm not familiar with the figures he's using as the basis of that, but I have right here in my hands an article from the front page of the Eugene Register Guard. Eugene's wind program, a product offered to customers, has now become fully subscribed to. This is a product that's only been around for about 4 or 5 years. We can't meet demand anymore. We've actually just unveiled a second product, EWEB Green Power, and we're already experiencing a real clamor and demand for that to the point where we're already trying to figure out a way to carve out a product that we can offer to the Olympic trials when they're held in Eugene in a few years to have a green event. So that kind of indicates, in my opinion, there's a lot of demand for this product at EWEB still. Back to the issue of trepidation on EWEB's part, I think, to use a baseball metaphor, our power planners were a little concerned we might start out on third base and only get a quarter of a run when we get to home plate. But I'm very heartened to tell you that today we feel really good about the state of the legislation today. We generally agree with OMEU's assessments of how the legislation measures up to key municipal principles, and more specifically, the following key concerns for EWEB have been remedied in the Dash 2s. Authorization for unlimited banking of renewable energy certificates for compliance purposes, exemptions for the BPA and Mid-Columbia portions of the utility's portfolio, And the third one, this is really ERO-specific, exclusions of non-fossil fuel resources from so-called displacement. And finally, we're heartened to see the local control of the compliance progress with reporting to ODO. In closing, we're extremely grateful to the committee, Chair Avakian, Senator Pazansky, the Governor's Office, and the members of the Renewable Energy Work Group for all the kind of troubleshooting that has brought these sorts of remedies to the table. We support the Dash 2 amendments and look forward to helping you refine this legislation throughout the session and refining it over the next 20 years and beyond. Thank you.
Committee? All right. Thanks, both of you. Very helpful testimony. Elizabeth Whalen, Dan Meek, Isidore Morgavi.
Good afternoon, Chair Avakian and committee members. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Elizabeth Whalen, and I'm the Director of Corporate Sustainability for Columbia Forest Products. Columbia is headquartered in Oregon with its corporate offices located in Portland. We have been in business for over 50 years, and our original mill today is located in Klamath Falls, Oregon. We do have 20 other operations across North America. We're the largest manufacturer of hardwood plywood, veneer, and flooring in North America, and we are an employee-owned company. Additionally, Columbia has a long history of environmental leadership and participation in the Forest Stewardship Council since it entered the U.S. market in the 90s. Most recently, we partnered with Oregon State University to develop a proprietary soy-based adhesive, which enabled us to eliminate formaldehyde from our manufacturing process, a known human carcinogen. We have since converted our Klamath Falls mill along with other operations, and in the process of doing so, we have benefited from emission reductions of as much as 95% at our mill locations. Sustainable forestry, the elimination of toxins from our products for the good of public health, and the responsible use of natural resources are not only a part of our business values, but they are a part of our business strategy. I am here today on behalf of Columbia Forest Products as an industrial consumer in support of this renewable energy standard because we believe that smart business practices and environmental business practices go hand in hand. Columbia knows firsthand that the costs of being an environmental leader are manageable and that implementation timelines can be speedy while also being reasonable, especially when industry and government collaborate. We applaud your efforts to solidify Oregon's position as an environmental leader in renewable energy, and we support these efforts in Senate Bill 838 wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Morgavi?
Good afternoon, Mr. Senator Avakian, members. My name is Isidore W. Morgavi. I live in the unincorporated area of Tigard at 15145 Southwest 119th Avenue. I'm here representing me, my children, and my grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren-to-be. I have long-term interest in this matter. I'm a retired electrical engineer retiring from Precision Cast Parts as engineering project manager. Last year was a record year. The number of billionaires and millionaires broke all previous records. Goldman Sachs, ExxonMobil had record earnings, as did many large companies. Yet business interests claimed that this bill would result in severe hardships to the industry, raise rates, and in general are reacting predictably to any requirement that they take some responsibility for what they are doing to the world we live in. History, if we have one, may very well show that the biggest mistake of our times was not the invasion of Iraq. Rather, it was the failure to sign on to the Kyoto Accord. Instead, we continue to kill and destroy on a much grander but less noticeable basis, scale, all in the pursuit of the money buck. At the same time, that same history may remember Al Gore for the documentary he inspired rather than for being President of the United States. The old building relics on Cannery Row in Monterey, California, stand in silent reminders to the once great sardine runs that are now gone forever. Remember the salmon tragedy? Tragedy? For years, protection was talked about and talked about and talked about until the inevitable consequences rendered all that babble moot. I remember the towns along the coast, fishing boats tied up with for sale signs on them, as were the homes of the fishermen who had not accepted that there is no unlimited supply of anything. Those are cameos of what the future holds if we continue to ignore the fact that we are destroying our world. You swore an oath to protect and serve the citizens you represent. There will never be a time when protection is needed more than it is now. Please don't let this turn into another fish story, because there will be no second chance this time. Senate Bill 373 and 838 are only a start, but they are a good start and should be approved, not only for Oregonians, for all of mankind. Thank you.
Mr. McGavie, I appreciate you making the drive down here. Thank you.
Mr. Drake, we have a copy of that.
Senator Bates has requested a copy of what you just read from, so if you don't mind,
certainly,
you can give that to Matt over at the table there. He'll take care of it.
Right.
Mr. Meek?
Good afternoon. good afternoon, Chair Avakian and members. My name is Dan Meek. I'm representing here the Utility Reform Project. We've been involved in utility issues in Oregon for about the last 25 years in various ways. While we support, in general, the mandate for renewable development in Oregon because of the externalities of thermal power generation, we would ask that the committee correct what are a couple of hopefully unintended anti-competitive provisions in the Dash 2 amendments. Now, when the monopoly status of privately owned utilities in Oregon is pointed out, their response is often, well, their competition is the opportunity for voters to create people's utility districts and to acquire their territory. But this bill would impair that opportunity in a couple of ways. First of all, Section 6, Subsection 2 is a provision that establishes a schedule for utilities that are small now, that is below 1% of the overall utility provision of electricity in Oregon, to meet a schedule for developing renewable resources based upon the time at which they exceed the 1% threshold. That is, they have beginning in the fourth year after they exceed the threshold, that's when the 5% standard applies, and then the 10, 15, and 25% standards apply according to a schedule that begins when they exceed the 1%. On the other hand, there is no similar provision for new consumer-owned utilities. That is, the new consumer-owned utility suddenly is over 1%. The large utility standard applies to them immediately. There is no phase-in. So I would ask that the same provision of Section 6, Subsection 2 be applied not only to existing consumer-owned utilities that grow above 1%, but be applied to new consumer-owned utilities that either grow or start out at above 1%. That is, the standards applied to them should be the same. They should not be discriminated against simply because they are new. Section 7, Subsection 4 basically says that the small utility standard of meeting 5% of the load by calendar year 2025 with renewables is automatically revoked and not available to any consumer-owned utility that acquires service territory of an electric company without the consent of the electric company. Well, that's a way of saying that the consumer-owned utility is acquiring territory or property by eminent domain, which is their privilege to do so. In the case of people's utility districts, it's in the Constitution. If utility is small, it doesn't matter whether it's small or big under this section, if you use eminent domain, you automatically have to comply with the large utility standard. In fact, if they comply with the large utility standard immediately, there is no phase-in. So we would ask here that instead of, again, discriminating against those who simply use their constitutional power of eminent domain, that these utilities be treated as the same as any other utility of the same size. Those are not penalized for using eminent domain. They don't suddenly have to meet a different standard because they used eminent domain. So in sum, I would ask that the bill be amended so that it doesn't discriminate against new consumer-owned utilities, and it doesn't discriminate against any consumer-owned utility simply because they use their legal power of eminent domain when they believe it's necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee? Nothing? Thank you, the three of you. Appreciate you being here. Is Jeff Robertson here?
Okay, Jeff, why don't you come on up? I don't see Jeff Hammerland in the room. Is he here yet? No. And I don't see Dave Moskowitz here either. If any of you know Dave Moskowitz, take a peek out in the hallway and see if he's here, because we're nearing the end, and I know he wanted to testify. So, Jeff, why don't you take the table for now? After Jeff will be Natalie McIntyre, and that is the last person I have signed up. Is there anybody that I have not mentioned that wanted to testify on the bill? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Robertson, you're up.
Thank you, Senator Vaughan and committee. And actually, I need to say thank you very much, Sue Marshall, for all your help in getting me here. I'm reminded of something that occurred to me a couple of years ago when I was in a course, and the gentleman drew a circle on the board, and he said, okay.
Oh, Mr. Robertson, go ahead and just say your name for the record before you begin.
My name is Jeff Robertson, and I'm from Ashland, Oregon. And anyway, there was a circle that he drew, and one of the wedges was everything you know. And the other wedge was, of course, everything you don't know. And then he asked me to identify what the rest of the circle was, at which point I was stumped until I heard the answer, of course, then I thought I knew it. But it was what you don't know that you don't know. And in this particular case, I feel that I'm sort of in that position, coming in very late in this entire proceeding. But what I wanted to do was to read from my testimony here and have you consider the addition of one other thing in your bill, some of which has already been touched upon earlier in some of the testimony.
Please do that, but also I know you've got about four pages, and if you could summarize the sure. most cogent parts and not read all four pages, we'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. What I am proposing is that in the portion of the bill where you are talking about renewable resources and excluding municipal waste, the one thing that I have not seen anywhere in my reading of it is any addressing of the technology which this entire paper is about, which is that there are other technologies which will produce electricity which will fall under. Actually, they would end up being able to use some of the things you're excluding. And specifically, the kind of technology I am talking about is what is called, in a variety of different names, depending upon who you're talking to, closed loop, or a hybrid gasification program. And I don't know how much any of you are familiar with those various programs, but they're in the back of what I submitted. There's a great deal of information just in terms of the data. But what this particular technology allows is the utilization of waste streams, various waste streams, and there's a wide variety, whether it be wood products, municipal waste, hazardous waste, medical waste, all of these things can be safely and cleanly transformed into renewable energy, specifically electricity. If that's what the goal is, which it seems to be. So one of the things I talked about in here is that if you took something like the city of Portland, which has, from what I understand, a rather full landfill, and instead of hauling all your municipal waste to Arlington, you were to simply put it through this technology, what you would be doing is effectively several things. You'd be cleanly transforming that MSW into electricity. You'd be getting rid of the need to truck it halfway across the state. And you could also use other things along with it, not that there's a shortage of waste in the general Portland area, to produce additional electricity. So that's the sort of quick summarization of it. If you would like me to go over any of the rest of this, I will be more than happy to, or you can read it yourselves, or if you have questions, we can do it that way if you'd like to make
well,
this
why don't up. We see if there are any questions. The committee is very good about reading the stuff that they're given, and
okay.
especially on this bill. And so, committee, anything?
Good question. I've been reading about the same sort of processes, and I think in the Midwest they're now looking at taking coal and using gasification and trying their first plant to use coal with zero emissions at the power plant,
right.
zero CO2 being by using this process, and Is that what you're talking about here?
That's what I'm talking about.
First plant's just going online, I think, in Ohio?
Yes.
I remember right?
That's where it is. I think it's a coal slurry or a coal powder that they're filling it with. Yes.
They'll be able to place that back in the ground where essentially it came from in the first place, so to speak.
Right. I mean, the other positive piece about this is that, I mean, you could install these plants, and they have a very small footprint. We're talking something 100 feet by 300 feet. And they're no more than typically at the highest point, which is the water cooling tower, which is 25 feet tall. And they pay for themselves. And after they finish paying for themselves, they generate a positive cash stream.
Mr. Chair, is there anything in this bill that would prohibit that kind of technology coming on as renewable energy?
I don't know that I can answer that question right now, but I think it's something that we can take a look at. I don't know
okay.
The answer.
I actually put language in here that may or may not be useful for you in adding it to what you already have that's existing.
Oh, I saw that in the materials, and you gave us some of the technical information about it, too, which we appreciate very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
I'm glad you were here. Thank you. Dave Moskowitz and Natalie McIntyre. These will be the last two folks testifying today. Mr. Moskowitz, why don't you go ahead when you're ready?
Thank you. Chair Vakian, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon and the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I have testimony that is fairly concise and a piece of information from the Hydropower Reform Coalition, of which Trout Unlimited and America and Water Watch are both members of. The renewable energy standards in Senate Bill 373 are a step in the right direction. We need an active agenda to improve our electric power mix, one that will soften the impacts to resources as our power needs expand. And it is an agenda that acknowledges that if we let the market be the only guide to our energy choices, we will continue to choose the cheaper and older sources of power generation. There is the reason that I'm here today to speak on behalf of these organizations is that we believe there's a glaring weakness in the RES as currently proposed. And the RES should be an engine for new low-impact technologies that need a regulatory entree or an incentive to become viable power producers. We believe that Senate Bill 373, as its current form, adopts a significant portion of a mature technology, hydropower, and not just new sources of low-impact hydropower, but also new dams. The RES should incentivize the best forms of hydropower, forms that innovate to reduce their footprint. One provision of the RES that has precisely this effect for existing hydropower facilities that first earn a low-impact certification, that they may be rewarded for their above-board improvements with up to 50 megawatts towards established RES goal. However, the remainder of the hydropower provisions in 373 fail to advance this kind of thinking. So we have two specific requests on the backside of the testimony. And one would be to redefine Section 4, Sub 4A, to describe the desired forms of hydropower facilities rather than defined by exclusion. So be explicit in that section. Now, we propose language on the attached fact sheet. In the alternative, you could limit the current exclusive description to development that does not involve new impoundments or diversions. The second request we make is to provide a clear definition of efficiency, which means more power for the same water. That definition will curb inappropriate use of the RES to dewater fish ladders or release more volatile flows. There may be language in the Northwest Power Planning Council's early documents in the early 90s where they define efficiency, and that might be a source for the committee and the drafters and the proponents of this bill to find a good definition for efficiency. think our main point, I'm going to conclude with our main point, is that hydropower does not need the RES to thrive in Oregon. And the RES, however, suffers from including inappropriate forms of hydropower within its terms. We urge the committee to improve the hydropower provisions and keep this bill moving towards promising technologies that merit your support. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and appreciate your long hours of hearing from many people on this.
Thanks, Mr. Moskowitz. Ms. McIntyre?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm glad that I got in under the wire here in support of the Renewable Energy Standard, Senate Bill 838. For the record, I'm Natalie McIntyre. I'm a senior policy associate with the Renewable Northwest Project. And the work that I do there for RNP focuses on transmission issues for renewables. So I'd like to spend the few minutes that I have today addressing some concerns that have been raised by others in these hearings about transmission and integration as they relate to the success of this bill. I want to focus first on integration and point to a lot of work that's been done recently through the Northwest Wind Integration Action Forum. We've come up with an action plan. The report is being released this week. And that group was a number of parties, including Bonneville Power Administration and the other utilities around the region. And they've identified a number of action items that can help the region to integrate more wind. I want to point to a couple of the messages or the key results of that report. First of all, it indicates that the region will have no technical problems integrating 6,000 megawatts of wind. Also, a number of the region's utilities have done integration cost studies. Some of those are still under review and underway. There's a range of costs, but suffice it to say that those costs are still a small percentage of the delivered power cost of energy. And lastly, the report points to a number of cooperative efforts that the region can take to reduce the integration costs of wind. I want to take another minute related to integration and kind of dispel one of the myths that I've heard in testimony about the one-to-one backup necessary for wind. That is not true. Utilities are very comfortable managing variability. They have done it all along, and they manage the variability of their load throughout the day. They balance a number of different loads against a number of different resources. Wind would be one of those resources that they would be using to serve their load, and it does add additional variability, but again, this is something that utilities are comfortable with, and they don't need to back up wind one-to-one with another dispatchable resource. Turning now to transmission, I think that the concerns that have been raised are real ones. The region does need more transmission capacity. It needs to make more efficient use of the existing transmission that we have, and we need to get on a path to building more infrastructure over time. But that situation is not driven by wind. The region is in that situation because we have not built much transmission infrastructure over the last 10 to 15 years, but we will need to solve that problem regardless of the resources that we choose. It is not something that will be driven by this bill, and it's something that we can solve again. So I also would point out that the transmission is, like integration, a small portion of the cost of delivered energy. So both of those things are small relative to the overall cost of the resources that we're looking at. And I'd also point to some studies that have been done, transmission planning studies, that indicate that the cost of building new transmission infrastructure for a portfolio that is based more on coal will be more costly than a portfolio or a portfolio of development based more on renewable resources. So I just want to finish by saying that we are addressing these issues in the region. We are addressing them cooperatively to maximize the benefits, both economic and environmental, for the region. And I hope that you won't let these concerns, which we are working on, deter you from your support for this bill and its economic and environmental benefits for Oregonians.
Committee?
Quick question, Mr. Moskowitz. In the Southern Oregon region, we have two dams that are large. in place, Applegate and Lost Creek. The water there is managed for flood control and was designed to be done for flood control, and the water levels are changed, temperatures changed to protect fish runs, primary salmon and steelhead. Having said that, I never saw the logic of not putting hydropower into those dams, but you indicate to me there might be a problem. On the flip side, there's Savage Rapids Dam down there, which produces no power, and we've been fighting for years to get it removed to open up the river for salmon runs. So what I need to know here is, from my point of view, as a fly fisherman and one who loves streams, why would you be opposed to a power station on the Applegate Dam or a power station on Lost Creek Dam? It's a renewable source. I'd much rather see power stations there than new dams going in somewhere else. I'm opposed to new dams, and I assume you probably are too, but retrofitting those seems to be a logical choice for renewable energy.
Chair Vaca and Senator Bates, and those are, I'm familiar with Lost Creek on the Rogue and not familiar with the Applegate, so I'd like to get back to you, but I will try to answer your question in that, for instance, Lost Creek, which is, and I think all those projects in the Rogue were flood control, is that correct?
That's correct.
And one remains half built. As you're aware, the Lost Creek Dam flooded most of the spring Chinook habitat, and that's why spring Chinook and the Rogue are in a
more.
If a facility such as Lost Creek was a good place to create energy from hydroelectric, hopefully it would have to go through. That facility is probably big enough that it certainly wouldn't qualify under any of the exemptions probably that exist under the FERC process. If you had to consider fish passage there, then maybe we can start talking about that issue. But giving a tax credit, certainly it's a fairly big incentive to put hydro in existing structure and not get more from it for the environment, because a lot was lost. I'm not familiar with the Applegate, but a lot was lost when Lost Creek went in, and so perhaps taking a step towards gaining something back could be go hand in hand with allowing hydroelectric in a facility like that that's for flood control.
Just a quick follow-up. There is no fish passage above that dam. The likelihood of that dam being pulled out, I think, is zip. And I would much rather see a hydroelectric project there than anyone considering a dam anywhere else in the Rogue system. And I would ask that you consider your position this very carefully, because I don't want to see more dams down there. We're talking about pulling them off the Klamath. We're talking about pulling out Savage. But we have to think about what we have in place and what's there, and can we make best utilization of it? And I just would ask you to think about that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. If I may respond just very quickly.
Just quickly.
Yes. Chair Vaca and Senator Bates, I hear your point, and I will we'll get back to you on refining this about this issue. I think that the creating large structures in the Rogue before looking at these would be unwise. So I'm sure we'll be able to have a conversation about that more specifically.
Okay. Thanks to both of you.
Senator
Bates, I must say I'm very disappointed that we sat here for 4 days talking about Oregon's rivers and other waterways, and you didn't bring up fly fishing till today. The very last person to testify, I just don't understand that.
It's with Penn.
Committee, a lot of testimony to consider, complex bill to consider, and you can see from the very testimony we've had that coming to the proper definitions that make everybody happy is an extremely difficult task. But next Tuesday when we come back, we'll start with a work session and get into the bill. So please study the bill very carefully. We will try to get you copies of any amendments that are submitted in advance of the hearing so that you can read all of the amendments and talk to whoever you need to talk to get information about them. But it would be my intent that we delve right into the text of the bill right away. And if we can, as quickly as possible on Tuesday, craft a bill that we can take a vote on. If we can't do that on Tuesday, we'll spill over till Thursday. But if it's possible to run through all of the amendments on Tuesday, that would be my desire. Anything else for today? All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 838, and we are adjourned.